sense of closeness, even just a little, toward the client. That's why during our initial one-hour meeting I tried so hard to discover as much as I could some aspects of the client that I could respond to. Naturally, this was easier with some people than with others. There were some I'd never want to have a personal relationship with. But as a visitor who was with them for only a short time in a set place, it wasn't that hard to find one or two appealing qualities. Look deep enough into any person, and you will find something shining within. My job was to uncover this, and if the surface is fogged up, which was more often the case, polish it with a cloth to make it shine again. Otherwise, the darker side would naturally reveal itself in the portrait. So, before I knew it, I had become an artist who specialized in portraits, and I became fairly known within this particular, rather narrow field. When I got married, I ended my exclusive contract with the company in Yotsuya, became independent, and, through an agency specializing in the art business, received individual commissions to do portraits for even higher fees. The agent in charge, a capable, ambitious person, was 10 years older than me. He encouraged me to be independent and take my work even more seriously. After that point, I painted portraits of numerous people, mostly in the financial and political worlds, celebrities in some cases, though I'd never heard of most of them, and made a decent income. Not that I became a great authority in the field or anything. The world of portraiture is totally different from that of the artistic art world, and different from photography too. There are a lot of photographers specializing in portraits who are held in high esteem and whose names are well known, but you don't find that with portrait artists. Very seldom is one of our works seen in the world at large. They aren't featured in art magazines or hung in galleries. Instead, they're hung in reception areas somewhere, forgotten, gathering dust. If anyone happens to look at those paintings carefully, someone with time on his hands, they still aren't about to ask about the artist's name. Occasionally, I've thought of myself as a high-priced artistic prostitute. I use all the techniques at my disposal, as conscientiously as I can, in order to satisfy my client. I possess that sort of talent. I'm a professional, but that said, it doesn't mean I mechanically follow a set procedure. I do put a certain amount of feeling into my work. My fees aren't cheap, but my clients all pay without any complaints. The sort of people I take on as clients aren't the kind to worry about price. People learned of my skill through word of mouth, and I had an unending line of clients, my appointment book always jam-packed. But inside me, I felt no desire whatsoever. Not a shred. I hadn't become that sort of artist or that type of person because I'd wanted to. Carried along by circumstances, I'd given up doing paintings for myself. I'd married and needed to make a stable income, but that wasn't the only reason. Honestly, I'd already lost the desire to paint for myself. I might have been using marriage as an excuse. I wasn't young anymore, and something, like a flame burning inside me, was steadily fading away. The feeling of that flame warming me from within was receding ever further. I should have washed my hands of that person I'd become. I should have stood up and done something about it. But I kept putting it off. And before I got around to it, the one who gave up on it all was my wife. I was 36 at the time. Chapter 2. They might all go to the moon.
I am very sorry, but I don't think I can live with you anymore, my wife said in a quiet voice. Then she was silent for a long while. This announcement took me by complete surprise. It was so unexpected, I didn't know how to respond, and I waited for her to go on. What she'd say next wasn't going to be very upbeat, I was certain about that, but waiting for her to continue was the most I could manage. We were seated across from each other at the kitchen table. A Sunday afternoon in the middle of March, our 6th wedding anniversary was the middle of the following month. A cold rain had been falling since morning. The first thing I did when I heard her news was turn toward the window and check out the rain. It was a quiet, gentle rain, with hardly any wind. Still, it was the kind of rain that carried with it a chill that slowly but surely seeped into the skin. Cold like this meant that spring was still a long ways off. The orangish Tokyo Tower was visible through the misty rain. The sky was bereft of birds. All of them must have quietly sought shelter. "I don't want you to ask me why." "Can you do that?" my wife asked. I shook my head slightly, neither yes nor no. I had no idea what to say, and just reflexively shook my head. She had on a thin, light purple sweater with a wide neckline. The soft strap of her white camisole was visible beside her collarbone. It looked like some special kind of pasta used in some specific recipe. Finally, I was able to speak. "I do have one question, though," I said, gazing blankly at that strap. My voice was stiff, dry, and flat.
"I'll answer if I can."
"Is this my fault?" She thought this over. Then, like someone who has been underwater for a long time, she finally broke through to the surface and took a deep, slow breath.
"Not directly, no."
"Not directly?"
"I don't think so."
I considered the subtle tone of her voice, like checking the weight of an egg in my palm. "Meaning that I am indirectly?" She didn't answer.
"A few days ago, just before dawn, I had a dream," she said instead. "A very realistic dream. The kind where you can't distinguish between what is real and what's in your mind. And when I woke up, that's what I thought. I was certain of it, I mean. That I can't live with you anymore."
"What kind of dream was it?"
She shook her head. "I'm sorry, but I can't tell you that here."
"Because dreams are personal?"
"I suppose."
"Was I in the dream?" I asked.
"No, you weren't. So in that sense, too, it's not your fault."
Just to make sure I got it all, I summarized what she'd just said. When I don't know what to say, I have a habit of summarizing, a habit that obviously can be really irritating. "So, a few days ago, you had a very realistic dream. And when you woke up, you were certain you can't live with me anymore. But you can't tell me what the dream was about, since dreams are personal. Did I get that right?" She nodded.
"Yes, that's about the size of it."
"But that doesn't explain a thing." She rested her hands on the tabletop, staring down at the inside of her coffee cup, as if an oracle was floating there, and she was deciphering the message. From the look in her eyes, the words must have been very symbolic and ambiguous. My wife puts great stock in dreams. She often makes decisions based on dreams she had, or changes her decisions accordingly. But no matter how crucial you think dreams can be, you can't just reduce 6 years of marriage to nothing because of one vivid dream, no matter how memorable.
"The dream was just a trigger, that's all," she said, as if reading my mind. "Having that dream made lots of things clear for me."
"If you pull a trigger, a bullet will come out."
"Excuse me?"
"A trigger is a critical part of a gun. Just a trigger isn't the right expression. She stared at me silently, as if she couldn't understand what I was getting at. I don't blame her. I couldn't understand it myself. "Are you seeing someone else?" I asked. She nodded. "And you're sleeping with him?"
"Yes, and I feel bad about it."
Maybe I should have asked her who it was and when it had started, but I didn't want to know. I didn't want to think about those things. So I gazed again outside the window at the falling rain. Why hadn't I noticed all this before?
"This was just one element among many," my wife said.
I looked around the room. I'd lived there a long time, and it should have been familiar, but it had now transformed into a scene from a remote, strange land. Just one element? What does that mean? Just one? I gave it some thought. She was having sex with some man other than me, but that was just one element.
Then what were all the others?
"I'll move out in a few days," my wife said, "so you don't need to do anything. I'm responsible, so I should be the one who leaves."
"You already decided where you're going to go?"
She didn't answer, but seemed to have already decided on a place. She must have made all kinds of preparations before bringing this up with me. When I realized this, I felt helpless, as if I'd lost my footing in the darkness. Things had been steadily moving forward, and I'd been totally oblivious.
"I'll get the divorce procedures going as quickly as I can," my wife said. "And I'd like you to be responsive. I'm being selfish, I know."
I turned from the rain and gazed at her. And once again, it struck me. We'd lived under the same roof for 6 years, yet I knew next to nothing about this woman. In the same way that people stare up at the sky to see the moon every night, yet understand next to nothing about it.
"I have one request," I ventured. "If you'll grant me this, I'll do whatever you say, and I'll sign the divorce papers."
"What is it?"
"That I'm the one who leaves here. And I do it today. I'd like you to stay behind."
"Today?"
she asked, surprised. "The sooner the better, right?"
She thought it over.
"If that's what you want," she said.
"It is. And that's all I want."
Those were my honest feelings. As long as I wasn't left behind alone in this wretched, cruel place, in the cold March rain, I didn't care what happened.
"And I'll take the car with me. Are you okay with that?"
I really didn't need to ask. The car was an old stick shift model a friend of mine had let me have for next to nothing back before I got married. It had well over 60,000 miles on it. And besides, my wife didn't even have a driver's license.
"I'll come back later to get my painting materials and clothes and things. Does that work for you?"
"Sure, that's fine. By later, how much later do you mean?"
"I have no idea," I said. I couldn't wrap my mind around the future. There was barely any ground left under my feet. Just remaining upright was all I could manage.
"I might not stay here all that long," my wife said, sounding reluctant.
"Everyone might go to the moon," I said.
She seemed not to have caught it.
"Sorry?"
"Nothing. It's not important."
By 7 that evening, I'd stuffed my belongings into an oversized gym bag and thrown that into the trunk of my red Peugeot 205. Some changes of clothes, toiletries, a few books and diaries, a simple camping set I had always had for hiking, sketchbooks and a set of drawing pencils. Other than these few items, I had no idea what else to take. "It's okay," I told myself. "If I need anything, I can buy it somewhere." While I packed the gym bag and went in and out of the apartment, she was still seated at the kitchen table. The coffee cup was still on top of the table, and she continued to stare inside it.
"I have a request, too," she said. "Even if we break up like this, can we still be friends?"
I couldn't grasp what she was trying to say. I had finished tugging on my shoes, had shouldered the bag, and stood, one hand on the doorknob, to stare at her.
"Be friends?" "I'd like to meet and talk sometimes. If possible, I mean."
I still couldn't understand what she meant. Be friends? Meet and talk sometimes? What would we talk about? It's like she'd posed a riddle. What could she be trying to convey to me? That she didn't have any bad feelings toward me? Was that it?
"I'm not sure about that," I said. I couldn't think of anything more to say. If I'd stood there a whole week, running this through my head, I doubt I'd have found anything more to add. So I opened the door and stepped outside. When I left the apartment, I hadn't given any thought to what I was wearing. If I'd had on a bathrobe over pajamas, I probably wouldn't have noticed. Later on, when I looked at myself in a full-length mirror in a restroom at a drive-in, I saw I had on a sweater that I favored while working, a gaudy orange down jacket, jeans, and work boots, and an old knit cap. There were white paint stains here and there on the frayed, green, round-neck sweater. The only new item I had on were the jeans, their bright blue too conspicuous. A random collection of clothes, but not too peculiar. My one regret was not having brought a scarf. When I pulled the car out from the parking lot underneath the apartment building, the cold March rain was still falling. The Peugeot's wipers sounded like an old man's raspy, hoarse cough. I had no clue where to go, so for a while I drove aimlessly around Tokyo. At the intersection at Nishi Azabu, I drove down Gayan Boulevard toward Aoyama, turned right at Aoyama Sanchome toward Akasaka, and after a few more turns found myself in Yotsuya. I stopped at a gas station and filled up the tank. I had them check the oil and tire pressure for me and top off the windshield washer fluid. I might be in for a very long trip. For all I knew, I might even go all the way to the moon. I paid with my credit card and headed down the road again. A rainy Sunday night, not much traffic. I switched on an FM station, but it was all pointless chatter, a cacophony of shrill voices. Sheryl Crow's first CD was in the CD player, and I listened to the first three songs and then turned it off. I suddenly realized I was driving down Meijiro Boulevard. It took a while before I could figure out which direction I was going, from Waseda toward Nerima. The silence got to me, and I turned on the CD again and listened to Sheryl Crow for a few more songs, and then switched it off again. The silence was too quiet, the music too noisy. Though silence was preferable, a little. The only thing that reached me was the scrape of the worn-out wipers, the endless hiss of the tires on the wet pavement. In the midst of that silence, I imagined my wife in the arms of another man. I should have picked up on that, at least, a long time ago. So how come I didn't think of it? We hadn't had sex for months. Even when I tried to get her to, she'd come up with all kinds of reasons to turn me down. Actually, I think she'd lost interest in having sex for some time before that, but I'd figured it was just a stage. She must be tired from working every day and wasn't feeling up to it. But now I knew she was sleeping with another man. When had that started? I searched my memory. Probably 4 or 5 months ago would be my guess. 4 or 5 months ago would make it October or November. But for the life of me, I couldn't recall what had happened back in October or November. I mean, I could barely recall what had happened yesterday.
I paid attention to the road so as not to run any red lights or get too close to the car in front of me, and mentally reviewed what had happened last fall. I thought so hard about it that it felt like the core of my brain was going to overheat. My right hand unconsciously changed gears to adjust to the flow of traffic. My left foot stepped on the clutch in time with this. I had never been so happy that my car was a stick shift. Besides mulling over my wife's affair, it gave me something to do to keep my hands and feet busy. So what had happened back in October or November? An autumn evening. I'm picturing my wife on a large bed and some man undressing her. I thought of the straps on her white camisole and the pink nipples that lay underneath. I didn't want to visualize all this, but once one image came to me, I couldn't stop. I sighed and pulled into the parking lot of a drive-in restaurant. I rolled down the driver's side window, took a deep breath of the damp air outside, and slowly got my heart rate back to normal. I stepped out of the car. With my knit cap on, but no umbrella, I made my way through the fine drizzle and went inside the restaurant. I sat down in a booth in the back. The restaurant was nearly empty. A waitress came over, and I ordered coffee and a ham and cheese sandwich. As I drank the coffee, I closed my eyes and calmed down. I tried my best to erase the image of my wife and another man in bed, but the vision wouldn't leave me. I went to the restroom, gave my hands a good scrub, and checked myself in the mirror over the sink. My eyes looked smaller than usual, and bloodshot, like a woodland animal slowly fading away from famine, gaunt and afraid. I wiped my hands and face with a thick handkerchief, then studied myself in the full-length mirror on the wall. What I saw there was an exhausted 36-year-old man in a shabby, paint-spattered sweater. As I gazed at my reflection, I wondered, where am I headed? Before that, though, the question was, where have I come to? Where is this place? No, before that, even I needed to ask, who the hell am I? As I stared at myself in the mirror, I thought about what it would be like to paint my own portrait. Say I were to try, what sort of self would I end up painting? Would I be able to find even a shred of affection for myself? Would I be able to discover even one thing shining within me? These questions unanswered, I returned to my seat. When I finished my coffee, the waitress came over and refilled my cup. I asked her for a paper bag and put the untouched sandwich in it. I should be hungry later on, but right now, I didn't want to eat anything. I left the drive-in and drove down the road until I saw the sign for the entrance to the Kan-Etsu Expressway. I decided to get on the highway and head north. I had no idea what lay north, but somehow I got the sense that heading north was better than going south. I wanted to go somewhere cold and clean. More important than north or south, however, was getting away from this city. I opened the glove compartment and found 5 or 6 CDs inside. One of them was a performance of Mendelssohn's Octet by E. Musici. My wife liked to listen to it when we went on drives. An unusual setup with a double-string quartet, but a beautiful melody. Mendelssohn was only 16 when he composed the piece. My wife told me this. A child prodigy. What were you doing when you were 16? I called up the past. When I was 16, I was crazy over a girl in my class. Did you go out with her? No, I barely said a word to her. I just looked at her from a distance. I wasn't brave enough to speak up. When I went home, I used to sketch her. I did quite a few drawings. So you've done the same thing from way back when, my wife said, laughing. True, I've done the same thing from way back when. True, I've done the same thing from way back when, I said, mentally repeating the words I'd spoken to her. I took the Sheryl Crow CD out of the player and slipped in an MJQ album, Pyramid. I listened to Milt Jackson's pleasant, bluesy solo as I headed down the highway toward the north. I'd make the occasional stop at a service area, take a long piss, and drink a couple of cups of hot black coffee. But other than that, I drove all night. I drove in the slow lane, only speeding up to pass trucks. I didn't feel sleepy, strangely enough. It felt like I'd never be sleepy again in my whole life. And just before dawn, I reached the Japan Sea coast. In Niigata, I turned right and drove north along the coast, from Yamagata to Akita Prefecture, then through Aomori into Hokkaido. I didn't take any highways and drove leisurely down back roads. In all senses of the word, I was in no hurry. When night came, I'd check in to a cheap business hotel or run-down Japanese inn, flop down on the narrow bed, and sleep. Thankfully, I can fall asleep right away just about anywhere, in any type of bed. On the morning of the second day, near Murakami City, I phoned my agent and told him I wouldn't be able to do any portrait painting for a while. I had a few commissions I was in the middle of, but wasn't in a place where I could do any work. That's a problem, since you've already accepted the commissions, the agent said, his tone harsh. I apologized. There's nothing I can do about it. Could you tell the clients I got in a car accident or something? There are other artists who could take over, I'm sure. My agent was silent for a time. Up till now, I'd never missed a deadline. He knew how seriously I took my work. Something came up, and I'll be away from Tokyo for a while. I'm sorry, but in the meantime, I can't do any painting. How long is for a while? I couldn't answer. I switched off the cell phone, found a nearby river, parked my car on the bridge over it, and tossed that small communication device into the water. I felt sorry toward him, but I had to get him to give up on me, have him think I'd gone to the moon or something. In Akita, I stopped at a bank, withdrew some cash, and checked my balance. There was still a decent amount in my personal account. Credit card payments were automatically deducted. For the time being, I had enough to continue my trip. I wasn't using that much each day. Gas money, nights in business hotels, that's about the size of it. At an outlet store outside Hakodate, I purchased a simple tent and a sleeping bag. Hokkaido in early spring was still cold, so I also bought some thermal underwear. Whenever I arrived in a place, I looked for an open campground, set up my tent, and slept there in order to save money. Hard snow still covered the ground, and the nights were cold, but because I'd been spending nights in cramped, stuffy business hotel rooms, I felt relieved and free inside the tent. Hard ground below, the endless sky above. Countless stars sparkling in the sky. That and nothing else. For the next 3 weeks, I wandered all over Hokkaido in my Peugeot. April came, but it looked like the snow wasn't going to melt anytime soon. Still, the color of the sky visibly changed, and plants began to bud. Whenever I ran across a small town with a hot springs, I'd stay in an inn there, enjoy the bath, wash my hair and shave, and have a decent meal. Even so, when I weighed myself, I found I'd lost 11 pounds. I didn't read any newspapers or watch TV. My car radio had started acting up from the time I arrived in Hokkaido, and soon I couldn't hear anything on it at all. I had no clue what was happening in the world at large, and didn't care to know. I stopped once in Tomakomai and did laundry at a laundromat. While I waited for the clothes to finish, I went to a nearby barber shop and got a haircut and shave. At the shop, I saw the NHK news on TV for the first time in a long while. I say saw, but even with my eyes closed, I could hear the announcer's voice, whether I wanted to or not. From start to finish, though, the news had nothing to do with me, like events happening on some other planet, or else some fake stories somebody had cooked up for the fun of it. The only news story that hit home was a report on a 73-year-old man in Hokkaido who'd gone mushroom gathering in the mountains and been attacked and killed by a bear. When bears wake from hibernation, the announcer said, they're hungry and irritable and very dangerous. I slept in my tent sometimes, and when the mood struck me, I took walks in the woods, so it wouldn't have been strange if I were the one who'd been attacked. It just happened to be that old man who got attacked, and not me. But even hearing that news, I felt no sympathy for the old man who'd been so cruelly butchered by a bear. No empathy came to me for the pain and fear and shock he must have experienced. I felt more sympathy for the bear. No, sympathy isn't the right word, I thought. It's more like a feeling of complicity. Something's wrong with me, I thought, as I stared at myself in the mirror. I said this aloud, in a small voice. It's like something's messed up with my brain. Better not get near anyone. For the time being, at least. Toward the latter half of April, I was sick and tired of the cold, so I bid Hokkaido farewell and crossed back over to the mainland. I drove from Aomori to Iwate, from Iwate to Miyagi, along the Pacific coast. The weather got more spring-like the farther south I drove, and all the while, I thought about my wife, about her, and the anonymous hands caressing her this very moment in bed somewhere. I didn't want to think about it, but I couldn't think of anything else. The first time I met my wife was just before I turned 30. She was 3 years younger than me. She worked in a small architecture firm in Yatsuya, held a second-level architect certificate, and was a former high school classmate of the girl I was dating at the time. She had straight hair, wore little makeup, and had rather calm-looking features. Her personality was not all that calm, but I only understood that later on. My girlfriend and I were on a date and happened to run into her at a restaurant. We were introduced, and I basically fell for her right then and there. She wasn't exactly a standout in terms of looks. There wasn't anything at all wrong with her appearance, but neither was there anything about her that would turn any heads. She had long eyelashes, a thin nose, was on the small side, and her hair, which fell to her shoulder blades, was beautifully styled. She was very particular about her hair. On the right side of her full lips was a small mole, which moved in marvelous ways whenever her expression changed. It lent her a slightly sensual air, but again, this was only if you paid close attention. Most people would see the girl I was going out with at the time as far more beautiful. But even so, one look was all it took for me to fall for her, like I'd been struck by lightning. Why? I wondered. It took a few weeks for me to figure out the reason, but then it suddenly hit me. She reminded me of my younger sister, who had died. Reminded me very clearly of her. Not that they looked alike on the outside. If you were to compare photos of the two of them, most people would be hard-pressed to find any resemblance, which is why at first I didn't see the connection either. It wasn't anything specific about her looks that made me remember my younger sister, but the way her expression changed, especially the way her eyes moved and sparkled, was amazingly like my sister's. It was like magic or something had brought back the past right before my very eyes. My sister had also been 3 years younger than me and had a congenital heart valve problem. She'd had numerous operations when she was little, and though they were successful, there were lingering after effects. Her doctors had no idea if those after effects would get better on their own or cause some life-threatening issues. In the end, she died when I was 15. She'd just entered junior high. All her short life, she'd battled those genetic defects, but never failed to be anything other than positive and upbeat. Until the very end, she never grumbled or complained, and always made detailed plans for the future. That she would die so young was not something she factored into her plans. She was naturally bright, always with outstanding grades, a lot better a child than I was. She had a strong will and always stuck to whatever she decided to do, no matter what. If she and I ever quarreled, a pretty rare occurrence, I always gave in. At the end, she was terribly thin and drawn, yet her eyes remained animated, and she was still full of life. It was my wife's eyes, too, that drew me to her. Something I could see deep in them. When I first saw those eyes, they jolted me. Not that I was thinking that by making her mine I could restore my dead sister or anything. Even if I'd wanted to, I could imagine the only thing that would lead to was despair. What I wanted or needed was the spark of that positive will, that definite source of warmth needed to live. It was something I knew very well, but that was, most likely, missing in me. I managed to get her contact info and asked her on a date. She was surprised, of course, and hesitated. I was, after all, her friend's boyfriend. But I kept at it. "I just want to see you and talk," I told her. "Just meet and talk, that's all. I'm not looking for anything else." We had dinner in a quiet restaurant and talked about all kinds of things. Our conversation was a little nervous and awkward at first, but then became more animated. There was so much I wanted to know about her, and I had plenty to talk about. I found out that her birthday and my sister's were only 3 days apart. "Do you mind if I sketch you?" I asked. "Right here?" she asked, glancing around. We were seated at the restaurant and had just ordered dessert. "I'll finish before they're back with dessert," I said. "Then I guess I don't mind," she replied doubtfully. I took out the small sketchbook I always carried with me and quickly sketched her face with a 2B pencil. As promised, I finished before our desserts arrived. The important part was, of course, her eyes. That's what I wanted to draw most. Back within those eyes, there was a deep world, a world beyond time. I showed her the sketch, and she seemed to like it. "It's very full of life." "That's because you are," I said. She gazed for a long time at the sketch, apparently taken with it, as if she were seeing a self she hadn't known before. "If you like it, I'll give it to you."
"I can have it?" she said.
"Of course, it's just a quick sketch."
"Thank you."
After this, we went on more dates and eventually became lovers. It all happened so naturally. My girlfriend, though, was shocked that her friend stole me away. She was probably thinking that we might get married, so of course she was upset, though I doubt I ever would have married her. My wife, too, was going out with someone else at the time, and their breakup wasn't easy either. There were other obstacles to overcome, but the upshot was that half a year later, we were married. We had a small party with a handful of close friends to celebrate and settled into a condo in Hero. Her uncle owned the condo and gave us a good deal on rent. I used one small room as my studio and focused on my portrait work. This was no longer just a temporary job. Now that I was married, I needed a steady income, and other than portrait painting, I had no means of earning a decent living. My wife commuted from our place by subway to the architecture firm in Yotsuya, and it sort of naturally came about that I was the one who took care of everyday housework, which I didn't mind at all. I never minded doing housework, and found it a nice break from painting. At any rate, it was far more pleasant to do housework than commute every day to a job and be forced to do work behind a desk. I think for both of us, our first few years of marriage were calm and fulfilling. Before long, we settled into a pleasant daily rhythm. On weekends and holidays, I'd take a break from painting and we'd go out. Sometimes to an art exhibition, sometimes hiking outside the city. At other times, we'd just wander around town. We had intimate talks, and for both of us, it was important to regularly update each other. We spoke honestly and openly about what was going on in our lives, exchanging opinions, sharing feelings. For me, though, there was one thing I never opened up about to her. The fact that her eyes reminded me so much of my sister who'd died at 12, and that was the main reason I'd been attracted to her. Without those eyes, I probably never would have tried to win her over as eagerly as I did. But I felt it was better not to tell her that. And until the very end, I didn't. That was the sole secret I kept from her. What secrets she may have kept from me, and I imagine there were some, I have no idea. My wife's name was Yuzu, the name of the citrus fruit used in cooking. Sometimes when we were in bed, I'd call her Sudachi, a similar type of fruit, as a joke. I'd whisper this in her ear. She'd always laugh, but it upset her all the same. "I'm not Sudachi, but Yuzu. They're similar, but not the same," she'd insist. When did things start to go south for us? As I drove on from one roadside restaurant to another, one business hotel to another, randomly moving from point A to point B, I thought about this, but I couldn't pinpoint where things had begun to go wrong. For a long time, I was sure we were doing fine. Of course, like many couples, we had some issues and disagreements. Our main issue was whether or not to have children. But we still had time before we had to make a final decision. Other than that one problem, one we could postpone for the time being, we had a basically healthy marriage, on both an emotional and physical level. I was sure of that. Why had I been so optimistic? Or so stupid? It's like I'd been born with a blind spot and was always missing something, and what I missed was always the most important thing of all. In the mornings, after I saw my wife off to work, I'd focus on my painting, then after lunch would take a walk around the neighborhood, do some shopping while I was at it, and then get things ready for dinner. Two or three times a week I'd go swimming in a nearby sports club. When my wife got back, we'd have a beer or some wine together. If she called me saying she had to work overtime and would grab something near the office, I'd sit by myself and have a simple dinner alone. Our 6 years together were mostly a repeat of those kinds of days, and I was basically okay with that. Things were busy at the architecture firm, and she often had to work overtime. I gradually had to eat dinner alone more often. Sometimes she wouldn't get back until nearly midnight. "Things have gotten so hectic at work," she'd explain. One of her colleagues suddenly changed jobs, she said, and she had to pick up the slack. The firm was reluctant to hire new staff. Whenever she came home late, she was exhausted and would just take a shower and go to sleep. So the number of times we had sex went way down. Sometimes she even had to go in on days off, too, to finish her work. Of course, I believed her. There wasn't any reason not to. But maybe she wasn't working overtime at all. While I was eating dinner alone at home, she may have been enjoying some intimate time in a hotel bed with a new lover. My wife was outgoing. She seemed quiet and gentle, but was sharp and quick-witted, and needed situations where she could be more social and gregarious, and I wasn't able to provide those. So Yuzu went out to eat a lot with women friends. She had lots of friends, and would go out drinking with work colleagues. She could hold her liquor better than me. And I never complained about her going out on her own and enjoying herself. In fact, I might have encouraged it. When I think about it, my younger sister and I had the same kind of relationship. I've always been more of a stay-at-home type, and when I got back from school, I'd hole up in my room to read or draw. My sister was much more sociable and outgoing. So our everyday interests and activities didn't overlap much. But we understood each other well, and valued each other's special qualities. It might have been pretty unusual for an older brother and younger sister the ages we were, but we talked over lots of things together. Summer or winter, we'd climb up to the balcony upstairs where we hung our laundry and talk forever. We loved to share funny stories and often had each other in stitches. I'm not saying that's the reason why, but I felt secure about the relationship my wife and I had. I accepted my role in our marriage as the silent auxiliary partner as natural, self-evident even. But maybe Yuzu didn't. There must have been aspects of our marriage that dissatisfied her. She and my sister were, after all, different people with different personalities. And, of course, I wasn't a teenage boy anymore. By May, I was getting tired of driving day after day, and sick of the same thoughts looping endlessly around in my head. The same questions spun around in my brain with no answers in sight. Sitting all day in the driver's seat had given me a backache as well. A Peugeot 205 is an economy car, and the seats weren't exactly high quality, the suspension noticeably worn out. All the road glare I'd stared at for hours was giving me chronic eye strain. I realized I'd been driving pretty much nonstop for over a month and a half, restlessly moving from one spot to another, as if something were chasing me. I ran across a small, rustic, therapeutic hot springs in the mountains near the border between Miyagi and Iwate, and decided to take a break. An obscure hot springs tucked away deep in a valley, with a small inn that locals would stay in for days to rest and recuperate. The room rate was cheap, and there was a communal kitchen where you could cook simple meals. I enjoyed soaking in the baths and sleeping as much as I wanted. I sprawled on the tatami, read, and recovered from the exhaustion of all that driving. When I got tired of reading, I'd take out my sketchbook and draw. It had been a long time since I'd felt like drawing. I started off sketching flowers and trees in the garden, then drew the rabbits they kept there. Just rough pencil sketches, but people were impressed. Some asked me to draw their portraits. Fellow lodgers and people who worked at the inn. People just passing through my life, people I'd never see again. And if they asked, I'd give them the sketches. Time to get back to Tokyo, I told myself. Going on like this would get me nowhere. And I wanted to paint again. Not commissioned portraits or rough sketches, but paintings I could really concentrate on and undertake for myself. Whether this would work out or not, I had no clue, but it was time to take the first step. I'd planned to drive my Peugeot across the Tohoku region and return to Tokyo, but just before Iwaki, along Highway 6, my car breathed its last. There was a crack in the fuel line, and the car wouldn't start. I'd done hardly any maintenance on the car up till then, so I couldn't complain when it gave out. The one lucky thing was that the car gave up the ghost right near a garage where a friendly mechanic worked. It was hard to get parts for an old Peugeot in a place like that, and would take time. Even if we repair it, the mechanic told me, it's likely something else will soon go wrong. The fan belts looked sketchy, the brake pads were ready to go, and the suspension was nearly shot. My advice? Put it out of its misery, he said. The car had been with me for a month and a half on the road, and now had nearly 75,000 miles on the odometer. It was sad to say goodbye to the Peugeot, but I had to leave it behind. It felt like the car had died in my stead. To thank him for disposing of the car for me, I gave the mechanic my tent, sleeping bag, and camping equipment. I made one last sketch of the Peugeot, and then, shouldering my gym bag, boarded the Joban line and went back to Tokyo. From the station I called Masahiko Amada and explained my situation. My marriage fell apart, and I went on a trip for a while, I told him, but now I'm back in Tokyo. Do you know of any place I could stay? I asked. I do know of a good place, he said. It's the house my father lived in for a long time by himself. He's in a nursing home in Izukogen, and the house has been unoccupied for a time. It's furnished and has everything you'd need, so you don't have to get anything. It's not exactly a convenient location, but the phone works. If that sounds good, you should try it out. That's perfect, I told him. I couldn't have asked for more. And so my new life, in a new place, began. Chapter 3. Just a Physical Reflection. A few days after I'd settled into my new mountaintop house outside Odawara, I got in touch with my wife. I had to call 5 times before I finally got through. Her job always kept her busy, and apparently she was still getting home late. Or maybe she was with someone. Not that that was my business anymore.
Where are you now?
Yuzu asked me. I've moved into the Amada's house in Odawara, I said. Briefly, I explained how I came to live there.
I called your cell phone many times, Yuzu said.
I don't have the cell phone anymore, I said. That phone might have washed into the Japan Sea by then. I'm calling because I'd like to go pick up the rest of my things. Does that work for you?
You still have the key?
I do, I said. I'd considered tossing the key into the river too, but thought better of it since she might want it back. But you don't mind if I go into the apartment when you're not there?
It's your house, too, so of course it's okay, she said. But where have you been all this time?
Traveling, I told her. I told her how I'd been driving alone, going from one cold place to the next, how the car had finally given out.
But you're okay, right?
I'm alive, I said. The car was the one that died. Yuzu was silent for a while. And then she spoke.
I had a dream the other day with you in it.
I didn't ask what kind of dream. I didn't really care to know about me appearing in her dream. She didn't say any more about it. I'll leave the key when I go, I said.
Either way is fine with me, just do what you like.
I'll put it in your mailbox when I leave, I said. There was a short pause before she spoke.
Do you remember how you sketched my face on our first date?
I do.
I take it out sometimes and look at it. It's really well done. I feel like I'm looking at my real self.
Your real self?
Right.
But don't you see your face every morning in the mirror?
That's different, Yuzu said. My self in the mirror is just a physical reflection.
After I hung up, I went to the bathroom and looked at my face in the mirror. I hadn't looked at myself straight on like that for ages. My self in the mirror is just a physical reflection, she'd said. But to me, my face in the mirror looked like a virtual fragment of myself that had been split in two. The self there was the one I hadn't chosen. It wasn't even a physical reflection. In the afternoon, 2 days later, I drove my Corolla station wagon to the apartment in Hiro and gathered my possessions. It had been raining since morning that day, too. The underground parking lot beneath the building had its usual rainy day odor. I took the elevator upstairs and unlocked the door, and when I went inside for the first time in nearly 2 months, I felt like an intruder. I'd lived there almost 6 years and knew every inch of the place, but I no longer was part of this scene. Dishes were stacked up in the kitchen, all dishes she had used. Laundry was drying in the bathroom, all her clothes. Inside the fridge, it was all food I'd never seen before. Most were ready-made food. The milk and orange juice were different brands from what I bought. The freezer was packed with frozen food. I never bought frozen food. A lot of changes in the 2 months I'd been away. I was struck by a strong urge to wash the dishes stacked up in the sink, bring in the laundry drying and fold it, and iron it if I could, and neatly rearrange the food in the fridge. But I did none of this. This was someone else's house now. I shouldn't poke my nose in where I didn't belong. My painting materials were the bulkiest possessions I had. I tossed my easel, canvas, brushes, and paints into a large cardboard box, then turned to my clothes. I've never been one to need a lot of clothes. I don't mind wearing the same clothes all the time. I don't own a suit or necktie. Other than a thick winter coat, it all fit into one suitcase. A few books I hadn't read yet, and about a dozen CDs. My favorite coffee cup, swimsuit and goggles and swim cap. That was about all I felt I needed. Even those I could get along without if need be. In the bathroom, my toothbrush and shaving kit were still there, as well as my lotion, sunscreen, and hair tonic. An unopened box of condoms, too. But I didn't feel like taking all that miscellaneous stuff to my new place. She could just get rid of it. I packed my belongings in the trunk of the car, went back to the kitchen, and boiled water in the kettle. I made tea with a tea bag, and sat at the table, and drank it. I figured she wouldn't mind. The room was perfectly still. The silence lent a faint weight to the air, as though I were sitting alone at the bottom of the sea. All told, I was there by myself in the apartment for about a half hour. No one came to visit, and the phone didn't ring. The thermostat on the fridge turned off once, then turned back on once. In the midst of the silence, I perked up my ears, probing what I sensed in the apartment, as if measuring the depths of the ocean with a sinker. No matter how you looked at it, it was an apartment occupied by a woman living alone. Someone busy at work who had next to no time to do any housework. Someone who took care of any errands on the weekends when she had free time. A quick visual sweep of the place showed that everything there was hers. No evidence of anyone else. Hardly any evidence of me anymore either. No man was stopping by here. That's the impression I got. They must have seen each other elsewhere. I can't explain it well, but while I was in the apartment, I felt like I was being watched, like someone was observing me through a hidden camera. But that couldn't be. My wife is a major klutz when it comes to equipment. She can't even change the batteries in a remote control. No way could she do something as clever as setting up and operating a surveillance camera. It was just me, on edge. Even so, while I was in the apartment, I acted as if every single action of mine was being recorded. I did nothing extra, nothing untoward. I didn't open Yuzu's desk drawer to see what was inside. I knew that in the back of one of the drawers of her wardrobe,